This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcast. Freedom was the slogan of the times. The word was invoked to justify everything, writes Louis Menand at the start of his wide-ranging and endlessly fascinating history of post-World War II culture, The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War. After years of economic deprivation, mass slaughter in two world wars, and the continuing negative, repressive example of the Soviet Union, most of what was called the free world was dying to bust out into something new and different. The Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Harvard professor, and New Yorker contributor discusses how major figures and movements such as Lionel Trilling and other literary and cultural critics, Allen Ginsberg and the Beats, Andy Warhol and the pop art movement, James Baldwin and black protest writers, Betty Friedan and feminists, the Beatles and pop musicians pushed all sorts of boundaries in relentless attempts to express themselves and radically transform cultural, economic, and political life. I talked with him about how those quests took on distinct but related forms, depending on the backgrounds of the people involved, and how understanding them is absolutely essential to understanding the good, the bad, and the ugly of contemporary America. Here is The Reason Interview with Louis Menand. Louis Menand, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me.
So early on, you write in your book, Freedom Was the Slogan of the Times. What do you mean by that? And how does that kind of frame, you know, the material that you're covering?
Well, freedom was the slogan of the times in a very specific way, in the sense that it was the slogan of the anti-communist free world in the early years of the Cold War. So it's just a term that is continually used by American politicians and by the American government. But it expands beyond that. Beyond what we would think of as political freedom, as I say, free elections, individual liberties, and so forth, it expands beyond that to a kind of existential kind of freedom, which is not so much what the laws or the government protects, those kinds of freedoms. It's more how you feel. An example that I use in the book is what I call driving a car freedom. So a lot of people, I'm one of them, feel very free when they're behind the wheel. But of course, there are very few things that you do that are more heavily regulated than driving a car. So why is it that people nevertheless feel some kind of, is it agency? Is it the possibility of something happening that's unpredictable? Or what is it about, or just kind of the fact that you're in control? What is it about that makes people feel free? And I think that existential sense of freedom is also very important in this period. That begins to infect the arts and culture generally. It infects people's sort of personal philosophies. And it kind of is a contagion that tends to spread everywhere. So that you find all kinds of different people for all kinds of different reasons invoking the value of freedom to justify whatever it is that they're doing.
So, you know, one of the early figures in the book, and obviously Sartre and kind of French existentialism looms large over a lot of this because it's so important to post-war America, but is Lionel Trilling, the Columbia literary critic who had one of the first modern surprise bestsellers with The Liberal Imagination, a collection of essays that came out in 1950. In a way, he is the antithesis of freedom, isn't he? He's like a very controlled, mannered person. If memory serves, and this may be mythology, but that he was the first Jewish professor tenured at Columbia. But so he had a kind of professional freedom that might not have been available to him 50 years earlier. But he's not, like, nobody would look at Lionel Trilling and say, wow, that guy really lets it hang out. How does he end up being a kind of controlling, spirit animal?
Yeah. So you're right. He's really an interesting figure. He wasn't the first Jewish professor tenured at Columbia, but he was the first Jewish professor tenured in the English department and one of the few Jewish professors at Columbia in the pre-war period, because Ivy League institutions were pretty blatantly anti-Semitic. So he had to overcome, he was an undergraduate at Columbia and a graduate student, before he became a professor there, and he had to overcome this institutional anti-Semitism in his own life and managed to do so with uncharacteristic displays of assertiveness when he was called out. So that's an impressive part of his biography. But you're right that after the war, when he writes the essays that are collected in Liberal Imagination, you wouldn't exactly call him the friend of permissiveness or other definitions of freedom of that kind. So his liberal anti-communism struck me as the most interesting in the New York intellectual world of the post-war period, because on the one hand, he's certainly, for ideologically, a liberal. As I say, he's supportive of civil rights, and he's generally has views that we would regard as progressive. But what cuts against it is a deep suspicion of utopianism, a deep suspicion of the progressive ideology that human lives can be made better through social programs and through government and so forth, a kind of feeling that human beings at the core of humanity is kind of to resist socialization, to resist efforts to make people better or healthier or, you know, more immoral and so forth. You, at some point, people just won't be changed. They don't want to be changed. And he valued that as a kind of anti-conformity element of human nature that he treasured. And it really informs all of his criticism after 1950. It's all based on this idea that human beings are at core really unreformable, and we shouldn't try to force them to be different from the way they are. So what's interesting, though, Nick, about this is that his most famous student, Allen Ginsberg, is the opposite of.
Yeah, I was just going to say this leads into a discussion of Ginsberg, his student, whose work he didn't particularly care for. And Ginsberg is the kind of personification of, you know, American exuberance after. You know, the Depression, World War II, stultifying. So let's talk a little bit about the Beats then. How do they, I mean, in a way that seems kind of obvious, but there's a lot of texture to your reading of it. How do they exemplify this theme of, you know, of freedom and of individualism?
So as you just said, Ginsberg was a student of Trilling's, and he wasn't just a student who sat in on his classes. He developed a very close relationship with Trilling as his teacher. This is in the late 1940s. And Trilling intervened on Ginsberg's behalf when Ginsberg had disciplinary problems with the college and later with the police. And Trilling was very helpful in keeping him out of deeper trouble. So they were actually quite close in a student-teacher way until Ginsberg wrote Howl. And Trilling disliked that poem very much, as you said, as you one would expect that he would. But Jack Kerouac was also a student of Lionel Trilling's, and so was Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who published Howl as City Lights Books in 1956.
And who just died earlier
just
this
died
year.
100, I don't know what he was.
101,
yeah,
I think.
Right, yeah. He was also a student of, he went to graduate school at Columbia, was a student of Trilling, was also infatuated with Trilling, who was a very charismatic teacher in those days. So it's interesting that he's in a way the godfather of the Beats, even though you think of them as really different, and you should. So I think for Kerouac and Ginsberg, and for a lot of writers in this period, would certainly include Norman Mailer, freedom meant the freedom to write whatever they wanted, freedom from obscenity laws, or for just general crackdown on personal expression. That, in a way, that's the most important value for them. And they win the day ultimately, because ultimately the Supreme Court throws out most obscenity prosecutions. By the mid-60s, that's all over. But in the 50s, it's a very live situation. So Howl, which has a few we call dirty words in it, like Hofstadter, is put on trial in San Francisco, in San Francisco Municipal Court, for obscenity. And there's a, you know, it's a fairly well-publicized event. This is 1957. So even in 1957, you couldn't use the word cocksucker in a poem. You couldn't publish it. So this is a big part of what goes on in the period, and it creates a kind of opening up of what counts as legitimate artistic expression.
One of the, really interesting facets of the book is, you know, I think I said, there's texture there. So you think about somebody like Jack Kerouac and On the Road, is that, you know, it's one of the reasons why I think a lot of us, either consciously or not, think of freedom behind the wheel of a car, yeah. because you can go elsewhere. But, and you point this out, that, you know, the book and Kerouac himself, I mean, this is not a, you know, certainly On the Road is not a happy-go-lucky book. It is really, it seems more driven by manic energy to get to where the party is, but it seems to have left, or, you know, there's a sense of desperation there. Can you talk a little bit about that, how that, you know, version or that mood kind of fritters around the edge of certain elements of kind of freedom in the Beats or more broadly in his works?
I think Kerouac is one of the most misunderstood figures in American literature, and the reason that you give, which is that On the Road is a very beautiful book. I mean, he's a great prose. It's very purple, his prose. You have to be able to tolerate that. But it's, given that, it's very beautiful, very poetic writing. And quite different from most of the other sort of dropout fiction of the 1950s and 1940s, of which there's a lot. His book is quite different in tone. It's also a very sad book, because they never really get to the party, as you say. It's like everything falls apart. They get back in the car, they go somewhere else, everything falls apart again. They're just constantly in motion in a kind of manic way. And they kind of want to settle down, but they can't find a place to do that. They don't have a lot of money. It's almost all totally male book. There are very few women. And women are just treated as kind of accessories. It's about, you know, it's a kind of very homosocial book. So all of that is very much about who Kerouac was. He was a sufferer. He was a Catholic. You know, his parents were French Canadian, and he took his writing incredibly seriously. So there's nothing happy-go-lucky about him at all.
It's kind of interesting as well that the Beats, or at least, you know, thinking of the two of the three of the Holy Trinity, were slaves to, you know, substance abuse. William Burroughs, I mean, and in his early novel, Junkie, talks about junk is a way of life. Addiction is just the thing that you are. And Kerouac drank himself to death in his 40s from alcoholism. So, and they also kind of play acted at being improvisational. You talk about how, you know, the myth of Kerouac, you know, just sitting down with a teletype roll of paper and typing out On the Road is just not true at all.
Yeah. You could also add Ginsberg to the list of writers who are interested in drugs. In his case, it was LSD, which he was
right. But he seemed to escape the. He's a genuinely fascinating character because from the 40s on, he was. You know, I don't want to say he's a Zelig, because Zelig is a hanger-on. He's actually like a prime mover.
Everywhere you look, he pops up. It's unbelievable.
I mean, he's even on a Clash record in, you know, in the early
80s. He would do anything. And he did do everything. It's really kind of amazing. We'll get back to this in a second. But about 20 years ago, I was teaching at CUNY Graduate Center, and Allen Ginsberg was teaching a seminar there, because he was on the faculty of Brooklyn College. And he wore a tie and a sort of flannel, you know, outfit. And he looked like an academic. And I said to my students who were taking a seminar with him, it must be unbelievable to be able to talk to a guy who knew everybody. I mean, from Lionel Trilling to William Burroughs to whatever. And they said, no, all he wants to talk about is Jack Kerouac.
Oh, wow.
And they thought that's really not interesting, which is, I think, a mistake. But
there is a tremendous, a couple of years or maybe a decade ago, the National Gallery in D.C. had a showing of his Polaroids that he took over the course of his life, instant photos. And they became less interesting as he became more famous, more conscious of what he was doing. But there's a tremendous picture of Neil Cassady talking with a car dealer somewhere in like Colorado or somewhere in the Plain States. And the car dealer, it's in the 50s, but he looks like he's from the Depression, the suit he's wearing and the hat and the shoes. And then Cassady has a kind of T-shirt on and a suit, a sports coat. His shoe is untied. And it's kind of like you see the divergent path of post-war and pre-war America.
Yeah.
What is memorable ultimately then about somebody like Ginsberg? I mean, Howl is a hugely important poem legally, and it, you know, and the book points out how, you know, up through the early 60s, it was, of essentially it was difficult to find an authorized copy, a legitimate copy of books like Tropic of Cancer or Lady Chatterley's Lover. Howell and the Obscenity Trial kind of blew that apart. But what about aesthetically? What kind of did Ginsberg have a broad influence, you know, on the culture of this kind of explosive freedom?
Yeah. So I'm going to go back and cover a few things that we didn't get to, and then I'll talk about that question. So one is that about Kerouac is that he's also a very photogenic guy. He's a very good looking man.
Yeah.
And of course, the subject of guys driving around in cars and so on was appealing to a certain audience. And so it became a marketing phenomenon. And the concept of the beat, which had been around since the early 1950s, becomes this kind of brand. And everybody wants to be beat, and there's a TV show with a beat character in it, beatnik character.
That's the Many Loves of Dobie Gillis. Yeah.
There's a beatnik character. The term beatnik is coined in 1957, the year of the trial. It's based on combining the word beat with the word Sputnik, because that was the year of Sputnik. They're both far out. So anyway, so it becomes this kind of fad. And Kerouac didn't want anything to do with that, because he felt the way people conceived of beats as kind of, you know, guys chasing girls and smoking pot and so on, and, you know, not caring about anything, was not who he was. And so one of the reasons he drank himself to death, most people think, just has to do with he couldn't escape this stereotype of the beat writer that he didn't feel he fit in with. He hated the hippies, for example, who were often thought of as, you know, the offspring of the beats. So that's one thing. The second thing has to do with the composition of On the Road, which you talked about. He was staying in an apartment, this is 1951, in an apartment that had been owned by an architect. And so he got this architect paper that he was taped together into this continuous scroll. That's the famous scroll, which still exists. You can look, sometimes it's displayed in museums or libraries. It's incredible to look at. And he started typing on the road, and he did not take speed. He just drank coffee. His girlfriend bought him coffee. And in 3 weeks, he wrote the manuscript for the novel. Now, one thing about that is that he'd already been trying to write the novel for years. As soon as he started going on these cross-country trips, he had notebooks, he tried to write a conventional novel. He spent a long time trying to figure out how to turn this experiences that he'd had with his friends into a book. And various influences led him in the spring of 1951 to do the typewriter thing with the scroll. But it's very difficult to write a novel when you can't go back and cross something out. I mean, it's not like, oh, this is an easy way to do it. So by having a continuous scroll, he prevented himself from crossing things out or revising things that he'd already written. He had to basically continue whatever it was he was writing until he got to the end of it. That's really hard to do, just as it's very hard to do a drip painting. We think of this as spontaneous, and actually Kerouac used that term, but it's not spontaneous at all. Try doing it. It's really hard to do. And then, of course, after he finished in 1951, he retyped the whole novel onto regular conventional pieces of typing paper, and he edited it. It wasn't published until 1957, so it went through many versions. It didn't just come out of the typewriter and go to the publisher. So that's sort of thing. Okay, so the last question is about what did Howell add culturally? So we already talked about the role that it played in the rewriting of obscenity law. The case that the Howell case was a, as I said, a municipal court case in San Francisco under California law. So therefore, it's not a Supreme Court case. Mm-hmm. But it prefigured the Supreme Court cases that involved Lady Chatterley, the books that you mentioned, mm-hmm. Tropic of Cancer, Naked Lunch, Fannie Hill.
And a couple of movies as well.
The movie
it's like amazing to look at those movies and be like, did I miss the sex scene or the nudity?
I mean, The Miracle is a famous example, but even the Lady Chatterley. Yeah. So the Lady Chatterley movie actually was the case, the Supreme Court. Anyway, so in addition to that, which is important, the thing about Howell is that the academic ideal of a good poem is what academics would call a verbal icon or an artifact. It's something that you perceive through the eyes and cerebrally. You understand it intellectually. A howl is a sound that's apprehended by the ear. It's based on the voice. So you're not supposed to try to figure out the ambiguities in the words and so forth the way you would do in, let's say, John Donne poem. You're just supposed to experience it bodily as it's expressed bodily by the voice of the poet. So this concept of the poetic form being based on the voice, which doesn't, it's not original with Ginsberg, but it becomes very important in the period to distinguish avant-garde writers like Ginsberg and Charles Olson and so on, Black Mountain poets and so on, from the more academic poets like, I don't know, John Hollander or Donald Hall. There's this anthology war that I write about in the book between the anthology of the academic poets, which is a poetry that, as I said, basically perceived cerebrally, and the sort of more avant-garde poets like Ginsberg. So that's an important, Howell's an important statement in that battle.
Yeah, I guess this is a good moment to ask then also about, you know, at the time where people like, you know, Ginsberg and, you know, pop artists and a variety of other people, abstract expressionists like Jackson Pollock are kind of exploding form and kind of giving way to an emotionalism might be an overstatement, but something, you know, where your artistic experience is rooted in the body rather than the mind. At the same time, you talk about academics, you know, particularly people, the fugitives who were at Vanderbilt and a couple of other Southern universities who are trying to create a science of criticism. How does that fit into this question of kind of freedom?
They intersect. I mean, they're at cross purposes.
Right.
So the Vanderbilt people become the new critics. And the new criticism, I'm sure a lot of your listeners know what it is, basically close reading of the text on the page with relatively little context, is the dominant paradigm in literary studies in the academy after 1945, really up till about 1960 or so. And then it's still there. I mean, I still think it's kind of the...
I mean, if you're an English major, you learn to explicate the text
what you do.
First and foremost. Right?
And you close read. And, a lot of the vocabulary of the new critics survives, and certainly the formalism that they represent is still kind of fundamental to English departments for all kinds of institutional reasons as well. Anyway, so that's what I'm describing as a cerebral approach, because you're trying to figure out the possible meanings of a line of poetry. You're not listening. You're not experiencing it with your ear. There's a
right.
sound element of it, obviously, because it is poetry, but it's not fundamentally bodily experience. So there's an emphasis on the body that you can find as early as Pollock, because the thing about the drip paintings, of course, is that he danced around them in the studio while he flung the paint on the canvas, and this was photographed because photographers are kind of interested in this crazy guy who was drip painting. The photographs get published in places like Life magazine, so millions of people see it. And this becomes, a Pollock painting then becomes not just what's on the canvas, but the act of painting itself becomes sort of part of the artwork. That's very influential in the 1960s. Among artists you would think of had very little to do with Jackson Pollock or abstract expressionism, but like the artists who create happenings and so forth, because they say Pollock showed that even acting, even making the work of art itself, is part of the artwork. And so there's a lot of body-centered art in the early 1960s, and then, of course, beyond that, that really harkens back to Pollock. So that current of emphasizing the more sensory aspects of art creation and art reception cuts across the current that comes from the new critics and formalism. In art criticism, the main figure is Clement Greenberg, which, as I say, tends to be ocular and cerebral.
You know, what about pop art? Because pop art emerges after abstract expressionism. It really, you know, becomes a big fad or, you know, a kind of marketing ploy in the early 60s. What is the relationship? How does that extend the developments and the kind of, you know, theme of freedom that was developing in the 50s?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one thing about pop art is that although we tend to think of it as an American, actually, it begins in Britain much earlier, about 10 years before the pop explosion here, from 1951, 1952. And the British pop artists, people like Eduardo Polozzi and Richard Hamilton, were very influenced by American magazine advertising. This was a period of great austerity in Britain after the war. Standard of living was very precarious. They had a lot of food rationing still. People did not own appliances like refrigerators and dishwashers and so on, washing machines. Whereas America was booming and it was a consumerist economy. Obviously, it was not suffering from the after effects of the war in the way that places like Great Britain were. So these artists, young artists, were fascinated by American consumerism. And they loved these advertising for American products, particularly cars. This is the era of the tail fin, you know. So they explicitly base their art and their aesthetics on this kind of popular culture. And that's really the origins of pop art. And the term pop art really begins with or originates with that group in the early 1950s. So when American pop art comes along, which is really 1962, kind of bursts onto the scene all at once, there's a precursor for it. It's already international. And then it just becomes more international. It's pop art is produced absolutely everywhere. So it's not just an American art form. Of course, none of them really are. Does it contribute to the idea of freedom? Yeah, I think, you know, in a certain sense, it liberates a certain kind of subject matter as appropriate for art by making art out of or representing objects that Clement Greenberg, the great champion of abstract expressionism, would have called kitsch, the opposite of serious art, popular culture. So suddenly popular culture becomes acceptable. You can make paintings out of soup cans and you can make Brillo boxes and, you know, gas station signs and things like that.
Should we take seriously people, you know, there's another way too, that some of the pop artists and certainly somebody like Andy Warhol, who, you know, grows up poor in an immigrant community outside of Pittsburgh, but, you know, is famous for saying things like, you know, the great thing about Coca-Cola is that everybody has, you know, whether you're a movie star or a beggar, the Coca-Cola is the same. There's a democratization of experience in world, in post-war America.
Yeah, that there is. I mean, the term that Warhol used for pop art was communism. Of course, it's a play on communism, but he meant what you're saying, which is that and this was a popular way to think about what was going on before people settled on the term pop art. Everyday objects, common objects, which were suddenly made available for artistic representation.
And, you know, one of the amazing things that I don't want to marshal all of the stats that you bring is that, you know, the material conditions that you talk about. You mentioned in England after the war, and I forget the exact percentages, but it was something like maybe 3% of English households had washing machines, whereas like, you know, 40% of American households did or whatever. But how much of the, you know, kind of freedom or, you know, and certainly an interest in consumerism or the idea that you're defining yourself as a person, partly by what you're consuming or what you decide you like. But it's just after the Depression and after the destruction of World War II, there's this immense economic boom that suddenly allows lots of different people to kind of make choices about what they want and how they're going to present themselves.
Yeah, the term that was used was consumer sovereignty. Consumer is king. So we have that today. You know, when I need to buy, I don't know, some kind of household appliance, I can go online and I can comparison shop all the available appliances, all the check the prices, look at the ratings, well, consumer reviews and whatnot, and presumably make the best choice. That's consumer sovereignty. And that's something that starts before the war. I mean, you see that in the 1920s and 1930s, but it booms in Europe after the war. So a classic example are self-service grocery stores. So we walk into a grocery store, supermarket today, we can choose items off the shelf. That's opposed to going into like a butcher shop and ordering from somebody behind a counter who then picks out the piece of meat and gives it to you, or a baker. So there are very few self-service grocery stores in Europe in 1945, but by 1960, they're all over the place. So that's the spread of consumerism. Consumerism is regarded as giving the consumer, the buyer, freedom to choose what product they want. So the state doesn't tell me, here's the kind of toaster that you have to have. I can choose from 10 different kinds of toasters. And that's what appealed to the British pop artists. They felt they were living in a scarcity economy in which they were basically forced to choose among a very narrow range of products. And in America, it looked like it was this just enormous cornucopia of available styles and so forth. And they liked that. They thought that that's what the future should be.
Before we continue with the recent interview with Louis Menand, I want to take a moment to introduce you to today's advertiser, Inkle.com. If you're like me, keeping up with the news has become a real pain. All the best news sites are locked behind paywalls, and the free stuff increasingly is just clickbait and fake news that nobody wants to waste time on. Imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the reliable news sites, an app that filters out fake news and clickbait but still shows you every important story from multiple perspectives to counter bias, where good news, positive stories are highlighted so you don't become despondent, and where journalists dig through news from around the world to find stories you wouldn't normally see. That's what an innovative Australian startup called Inkl, I-N-K-L, has come up with. Inkl.com has signed partnerships with over 100 news sources like The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, and has created a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best-of-news feed. The service unlocks more than $12,000 of premium news for just $100 a year. And if you go to Inkl.com/reason right now, they'll give you an additional 25% discount, so you can get a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. That's Inkl.com/reason, Inkl.com/reason. And now, back to the Reason interview with Louis Menand. So, you know, this, we've been talking about a kind of, for lack of a better term, a kind of mainstream experience of a post-war, kind of boom in consumption and in freedom and whatnot. Your book talks a lot about how this period and the theme of freedom played out among Black writers, among women writers. Talk a bit about how James Baldwin, and maybe before him, Richard Wright, James Baldwin, Ralph Ellison, as three kind of markers of writers of the Black experience. How do they experience freedom? How do they articulate it in their works? And what do they see as the limits to freedom?
Yeah. Well, let's just stick with Baldwin for a second, because he's the one I have most to say about. He's fascinating, very complicated person. Grew up in Harlem in pretty bad living conditions. After high school, moved to the Village, got involved in the art scene, tried to start writing a novel. And he's brought to the attention of Richard Wright, who was then living in Brooklyn, I think. And Richard Wright was a very famous writer because he published Native Son in 1940, and then he published his autobiography, Black Boy, most of which were huge bestsellers, and they translated into many languages. So he was well off. And he liked meeting young Black writers, so he was introduced to Baldwin, and Baldwin went out to see him at his house, and Wright arranged for Baldwin to get a fellowship, which enabled him to work on his novel without having to hold a job. And then Richard Wright moved to Paris because he felt he could no longer live in the United States because of racial discrimination. And he settled there, ultimately spent the rest of his life there. About a year after that, Baldwin moved to Paris because he also felt he had suffered from discrimination, not just racial discrimination, but also because of his homosexuality. So for both of them, Paris represented freedom in the sense that race and sexuality were not big issues for French people, at least in Paris. And they felt they could live without suffering from discrimination, which to a large extent was true, certainly compared to what they were experiencing in the United States. So Baldwin goes to Paris, and the first thing he does practically when he gets there is write an essay attacking Native Son. And he continued through his career attacking Richard Wright, this guy who basically had been his mentor and had helped get money for him to write his first novel. He attacked him. So what Baldwin felt about Native Son was that Native Son presents its Black characters, in particular the protagonist, Bigger Thomas, as a victim. And it bought into an idea of Black-white relations as oppressor-oppressed. And that Richard Wright, in duplicating this dichotomy or this binary, was himself a victim of that binary. He was unable to transcend it. I think that's a little bit too fine an analysis of Native Son, but that was Baldwin's analysis. So he thought that in order to escape victimhood, even when you're attacking it, as Richard Wright was doing in Native Son, you need to emphasize that Black people have autonomy. They have their own lives. They're not just the object of white oppression. And on top of that, there are Black-white interactions in American culture. They're not completely separate worlds. And that Richard Wright was not recognizing or acknowledging this, according to Baldwin. So For Baldwin, freedom meant precisely that, recognizing that Black people have their own experience. That experience is completely valid. They don't need white people. White people should get their own heads on straight. And that became his message. So he stays in Paris till 1957, which is a year after the end of the Montgomery bus boycott. And he comes back and he associates himself with the civil rights movement. And so into the early 1960s, he's kind of a public figure who's talks about civil rights issues and racial issues with the press and so on. Eventually gets himself into trouble, which we could talk about later. But so he becomes a kind of spokesperson for Black equality.
What can you extend that into the 60s? One of the things that you point out, by the early 70s, people in kind of mainstream intellectual America, or at least middle brown intellectual magazines, were like, well, Baldwin was passé. Which is fascinating because he's obviously, for a variety of reasons, has enjoyed a resurgence. But even in the mid-60s, Eldridge Cleaver, as the Black Power movement is gaining steam in Soul on Ice, has a particularly kind of brutal and punishing and homophobic reading of James Baldwin, even as Baldwin was kind of celebrating, a kind of increasingly radical Black Power movement. What was going on there and how did that play?
Yeah, it's a fascinating episode. So Baldwin comes back to the United States. He's published his second novel. As I say, he associates himself with King in particular, who he particularly admired, Martin Luther King. He's at the March on Washington. He's at the March from Selma to Montgomery, the Voting Rights March, 65, and so on. His photograph appears everywhere. You know, he's a very charismatic, telegenic figure, and also incredibly articulate guy. Like, he's a great public speaker. So anyway, so he...
Famously, I mean, totally kicks William F. Buckley, who is, a verbal logorrheic wordsmith's ass in a debate.
With the Cambridge Union. Yeah, so you can watch that on YouTube. You get an idea of what his abilities were. He was a preacher when he was a kid. So he was very good at that stuff. Anyway, so he's perfectly poised to do this. And then in 1962, he publishes his third novel called Another Country. It becomes a bestseller, even though it's kind of a difficult novel to read. It's not exactly popular fiction, but, it's very celebrated. Then in 1963, he publishes The Fire Next Time, which is probably the most famous book, and is on the cover of Time magazine. So he's at the acme, as it were, of his public career. And then it all goes south for him. And that's interesting why that happens. So from the point of view of people like Eldridge Cleaver or Leroy Jones, who also attacks him, kind of the father of the Black Arts Movement.
Right. Later known as Amory Baraka, or more famously known as Amory Baraka.
Yeah, 65. So he also attacks, well, he's still Leroy Jones, he attacks Baldwin. I think those writers saw Baldwin as essentially sucking up to the white establishment. In other words, because he was on the cover of Time, he was already kind of illegitimate from their point of view, because they were Black nationalists. They didn't care about whitey, and they felt Baldwin did. I think they misunderstood him a little bit.
And also that Baldwin was kind of European, right? That he believed in a global kind of culture, and that Western, Western civilization had something of value.
He totally, so did Richard Wright. They thought the future for Africa is the West. Africa needs to modernize. So they were unapologetic about it. So that also didn't fit very well with Black.
And being homosexual didn't help either.
No, probably didn't help. I mean, that stuff that Cleaver wrote is disgusting.
Right. Well, I mean, he essentially figures James Baldwin as being sodomized by Western civilization. I mean, literally, characterizes.
He wants to have a child by a white man, is what he puts it. Yeah. So interestingly, Baldwin, this is where it gets really complicated. Baldwin falls out of favor with white liberals. Why? Because he says white liberals have to own their own part in the regime of white supremacy. White liberals don't like to hear that because they don't think of themselves as racially biased. And so there's this kind of backlash. Susan Sontag, Hannah Arendt, various people say, Baldwin's gone too far, or, it's just rhetoric, or whatever. They attack him. And he's vulnerable for lots of reasons for being attacked, but there's a quick backlash against him. And then he almost as quickly disappears from the scene. He no longer is the person everybody wants to talk to. So by 1972, as you said, Henry Louis Gates Jr. was then reporter for Time magazine, goes to France, where Baldwin had a house in the south of France, interviewed him for a piece, and Time magazine said, "We're not interested, he's passé." 1972. 10 years before he'd be on the cover of Time. 9 years before on the cover of Time. So that was, he very quickly went out of favor. But what's the interesting part, the really complicated part, is he makes friends with Elvis Cleaver. He makes friends with the Panthers. He moves to the left as the whole sort of black nationalist thing goes. He goes, gets on board with that. Why? Because he wants to identify with black experience. He doesn't identify with white people at all. But he's mischaracterized as somehow complicit in a kind of integrationism that the black nationalists rejected.
But then the Panther movement certainly just kind of disappears. That turns out to be, artistically and probably politically somewhat a dead end.
Well, the Panthers disappear partly because the FBI made sure that they...
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, it became an extremist group associated with violence, which is not popular. And in the general debacle of the late 60s, early 70s, it was one of the things that went down. What was surprisingly didn't last also is the black arts movement. Roy Jones or Mary Baraka, as you said, other figures. That's very big in the late 60s, very community-based work, very race-based, kind of not interested in white culture and so on. That didn't really work either. And then you get this kind of lull in race relations where things are just kind of bad in a general way. Nobody wants to do anything about it for the next 10 or 20 years.
What about the female experience or the feminist experience? Because obviously, and you point out, you mentioned Norman Mailer, who ends up in Paris as well. Everybody, in order to become really American, you had to live in Paris for a while. And Mailer, you in a section where you're talking about the rise of feminism and people like Betty Friedan and Susan Sontag as major intellectuals or figures in the 60s, you discuss, Norman Mailer's stabbing of his second wife at a party that's weeks before he's about to announce as mayor, running for mayor of New York. And what is astonishing, among other things, is that virtually everybody involved, even some women, are like, well, Norman Mailer, he was just, he had to be free and he had to stab the bitch, that was, harshing him or whatever. How can you talk about how Betty Friedan kind of emerged as a cultural figure or a spokeswoman for a uniquely female interpretation of what the post-war period meant and how that ends up in somebody like Susan Sontag?
Yeah, so the stabbing takes place in 1960. And as you say, it's kind of astonishing that almost everybody who knew the Mailers blamed it on Adele, the wife. And they thought, Mailer was going through some kind of dark night of the soul or something, and that's what artists do or whatever. I mean, it was just really amazing, including Baldwin. Who knew Mailer. So that was kind of astonishing, but that just gives you an idea of the misogyny of this period, 1960.
And you mentioned that, compared to like 1920, there were fewer women PhDs, fewer women in academia and things like that. So there had been a kind of retrenchment throughout the early post-war
it's very weird because just from a kind of national human resources point of view, it's completely irrational to say half of your population should not be in the workforce. That's just nuts. A lot of these are really well-educated people. Or shouldn't even have a college education. I mean, it's crazy.
Right.
Race discrimination is also irrational, but the gender thing was nuts. So what's surprising is it took that long until 1963 before anybody kind of woke up to this and realized this is stupid. And Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, was published in that year. So she's articulating something that people have been sort of trying to grasp for a while, but she really put it in a form that not just explained what the situation was in terms of gender relations, but did it in a way that women could identify with. So Simone de Beauvoir had written a book called The Second Sex in 1948. Basically, it's the same book, but it was for intellectuals, for people like Beauvoir. But Friedan's book was a book that any woman could read. And so women really felt, oh, she gets it. I don't.
Right. And you mentioned she interviewed, you know, actual women. I mean, she was a reporter, a magazine writer. She knew how to kind of
interview people. And so, as Beauvoir, of course, didn't. I think Beauvoir's book is a great book, but it's a completely different kind of project. She went out and interviewed people, and she learned a lot about what women were going through, which had not been her own experience, by the way, even though she portrayed it differently. Right. She went to Smith College at a time when women were taken seriously. She felt she had a great education. She felt she was equipped to go out and get a job and so forth. She combined that with marriage and children. She wasn't disaffected herself. Later on, she started blaming her problems on all that stuff. But at the time, that's not why she wrote the book. She
Point out that the younger graduates of Smith were, or younger women graduates of kind of sister schools were going to college for an MRS degree, and that struck her as
strange. She went back to Smith for her, I think, 20th reunion or something, and she interviewed these young Smith women, girl students, and she just thought they were complete airheads. They didn't care about school. They didn't talk about their work or their schoolwork. They were interested in dating, and they wanted to take classes that would allow them to leave campus for the weekend to go watch a football game at Harvard and Yale. And she just thought, this is terrible, because these women are fooling themselves into thinking that the only thing they need to be fulfilled in life is to marry a successful man. They'll find, at some point, they'll find that they need to have resources that they don't have. And she felt she had acquired those resources when she was a Smith student earlier. So she largely wrote the book to address the younger generation of women.
So feminism is, you know, I mean, by the end of the 60s, the women's movement, the gay liberation movement and whatnot had come on, and they're kind of they're natural developments in kind of the theme of freedom, or of maybe not consumer sovereignty, but individual sovereignty in the post-war era.
Yeah, you mean, one thing that happens, I think, is that by virtue of its geopolitical messaging, the United States portrayed itself as standing for freedom and equality. And therefore, it has to live up to those ideals. So, as a lot of people believe, I think that the civil rights movement in the United States was hugely empowered by the fact that the rest of the world is undergoing decolonization, which means that non-white people are taking charge of all these former colonial states and turning them into sovereign states. So the membership of the United Nations increases, you know, exponentially in this period because of that. So the United States wants to be on the right side of decolonization. It can't be on the right side of decolonization if it's well known that a large number of Americans are being discriminated against and oppressed on account of race. So women's movement, and then starting in 1969, the gay liberation movement are all part of that general social movement, which I think is, as I say, given a particular impetus by the nature of post-war geopolitics, not just the Cold War itself, but also decolonization.
So, you know, Susan Sontag emerges towards the end of the book as a major figure, and she's kind of interesting in the way you're talking about stuff, because in essays, you know, which are hugely influential to this day, and, you know, something like Against Interpretation, where she's kind of positing a less intellectual understanding of art and a kind of erotics of where you experience an artwork rather than immediately try to abstract it out into an intellectual experience. Yet she herself seemed to be devoid of bodily pleasure. Can you talk a little bit about why she's important and how she, I don't know if she brings us back to Trilling per se or to the New Critics, but she, you know, she's, there's at least, you know, several types of ambiguity and irony involved in her kind of existence as a major cultural force.
Yeah, Susan Sontag was a super intellectual. I mean, she was an intellectual's intellectual. And people who knew her and reported about her, this is in the recent biography, reports this by Ezra Moser, say that she had a strictly cerebral relationship to art. They found it rather frustrating. But the thing about Sontag, which I think makes her important, is that she actually was very interested in where culture was going. She wanted to kind of get what the next step was going to be. And she was an incredibly sort of attentive, hardworking critic who saw everything, talked to everybody, knew everything, was extremely well-versed both in continental philosophy and in Western music and in film and so on. So she writes those essays in 1964, 1965. It's not so much because she herself has an erotic relationship to art, but she knows that's where it's going. She could see it happening around her. And so she writes that essay, which is very influential. And that gets back to something we were talking about earlier, which is the emphasis on the body as opposed to the mind in the way we think about aesthetic experience. And she articulates an important version of that. She also articulates a version of anti-highbrow, lowbrow distinction. Even though she herself, again, was a super highbrow, she can see that people are enjoying listening to the Beatles, they're enjoying listening to the Supremes, they're watching Hollywood movies, that people don't care anymore about whether something's highbrow or lowbrow. So she helps blow up that structure of hierarchies.
It's an interesting kind of thing because she herself is a super snob.
Super snob, right? Yeah.
Famously, I know Camille Paglia never misses an opportunity to point out that Susan Sontag won't shut the fuck up about not owning a TV, as if that's a mark of distinction.
A very old-fashioned American intellectual, but she got what was happening. That's the thing. Yeah. That's what she was.
And then you talk about that Sontag, and this kind of leads into the final section of the book. The Vietnam War kicks into high gear in the mid-60s, between 1965 and 1968. We went from effectively zero troops in combat to over 500,000. And that changed Sontag. And how did that also change the kind of, thematics of freedom in post-war America?
Yeah, Vietnam changed everything. As you say, it's the last chapter of my book because the first chapter is about George Kennan and the policy of containment. And Vietnam is a crisis of the policy of containment. So as your listeners all know, the policy of containment was keep the communists in their box. We have to care about what goes on inside that box. That's their problem, but they have to stay in the box. So the question is, does the policy of containment mandate that we oppose militarily the North Vietnamese invasion of South Vietnam? And there's no good answer to that question. Kennan was against the war, or he thought the war was being pursued in a stupid way, but he was unclear about whether he meant that when he articulated the policy of containment. So Vietnam is a good endpoint for my story because it's kind of that's when the whole foreign policy of the United States has to change. And then, as you say, it also radicalized and politicized everything. So Susan Sontag was a super formalist. I guess interpretation of those essays are all about all thing that matters about art is the form. So you can admire Leni Riefenstahl's Nazi movies because we just bracket the Nazi part, right? So that's a classic formalism. That's what Clement Greenberg, that's what the New Critics were all about. We bracket.
Yeah, it's amazing with the New Critics too, because I mean, as you point out, they wrote the manifesto, I'll Take My Stand, as 10 Southerners or whatever. And they were, most of them at various points in their lives were absolute segregationists and they didn't want to talk about politics.
Right.
It's kind of a comfortable thing when all you're talking about is the text on the page.
I mean, they were very ideological when they were young, as you say. They were Southerners, very partisan Southerners. And then when they became academics, they kind of shed all of that. So formalism allows you to do that. Formalism allows Protestant critic in 18th century to look at Catholic paintings, Italian paintings, and not worry about the Catholicism part. So Sontag inherits that tradition of aestheticism. That all changes after 1965 for the reason that you gave, because once we get involved in the war, Sontag becomes super politicized, her whole rest of her career is politicized, and all these writers do, and all these artists do. And the nature of culture changes because it's suddenly all about the U.S., it's this imperialist power, about racism, all that stuff becomes in the forefront of the artistic world, which it really wasn't. John Cage has nothing to do with politics, He's the main figure in the 50s. That's all changes after 1965.
And you talk about how, you mentioned Ramparts Magazine and Warren Hinkle and a few others who also, around this period to discover or, expose the fact that in high culture, a lot of it was funded by the CIA or that it too was, it appeared to be one thing, but then it was entangled in politics in a very real way.
Yeah, after 1950, the CIA was very involved in covertly supporting all kinds of groups that were thought to be independent of the government. Most of these groups were political. Sometimes there were unions and so forth. But a few, and there are a few cases where they supported the arts, the most well-known of which is something called the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which was a supposedly independent international agency based in Paris, which was actually a creature of the CIA. And the Congress for Cultural Freedom published magazines in various European countries, including England, where it's called Encounter. And almost every important American intellectual, including like people like Jack Kerouac, contributed to Encounter. And it turned out they were being paid by the CIA when it was all revealed in late 1960s. And that also was a crisis, because suddenly people looked back and they thought, what was it really all about? You know, who was speaking to who here? What shocked intellectuals was they said, nobody told us what to say. The important thing was they didn't have to be told what to say. They were saying exactly what the U.S. government wanted them to say, which is not, of course, what they thought of themselves as. So that's also a huge crisis that happens around the same time. So the Rampart story is 1967. And by then, Vietnam is just completely blown up. And it's, you know, it's colored everything in American political.
And of course, the 70s then has official, you know, government commissions, whether it's the Church Committee in the Senate or the Rockefeller Commission, you know, showing how the CIA, the FBI, the NSA were all, you know, surveilling everyone. There is a weird cognate to this, too. You talk about the shift from kind of new criticism to post-structural theory in the academy, or at least in literary and cultural studies. And Paul DeMaan, who is the person who is probably less known to the general public, but, you know, is the kind of patient zero of deconstruction in America. And of course, he ultimately was revealed to have been a Nazi collaborationist, right? So what is that? Is the fear kind of haunting the freedom of post-war cultural production, the idea that you think you're acting freely, but you're actually a you know, a tool in somebody's game? Like you don't understand the kind of play that you're in.
Yeah, that's how we feel today. I think we feel that you're deluding yourself if you think you have real autonomy, because you don't. Let's take the example of consumerism. So in the 1950s, people did think of this as an exercise of freedom when they chose what kind of washing machine they wanted or whatever kind of car. So today we have enormous consumer choice. It's overwhelming, really, but it's all being governed by algorithms that we don't have any control over. So every time we buy a product, you know, all these databases know what kind of product we're likely to buy the next time we go online, and they try to get us to buy their product. So we have the illusion that we have complete access to all these options, but actually access is controlled by whoever's going to make money off of it. So we know that too. So we feel, well, we only feel free. We're actually, you know, mm-hmm. our choices are actually dictated by things we have no control over. And that's true of a lot of life today, is that people are very suspicious of the idea of genuine autonomy, but that people really believed it was possible in the 50s and 60s. That's what's striking right. about the period.
Do you buy that, or is certainly the illusion of complete autonomy is always a fantasy, but the idea of complete control, and I'm thinking in the 50s, even as there was the kind of rush to consumer sovereignty, there were also books like Vance Packard's The Hidden Persuaders, where, you know, you think you're buying this model of refrigerator, but in fact, the depth boys, psychologists working with ad men had programmed you to think you wanted that. And, you know, we're kind of seeing a resurgence of that. Do you think, is the truth somewhere in between these things? Or is it through revealing the machinations of cultural production as well as economic production that we get to some, I don't know, you know, realistic understanding of the limits of, you know, what we can do in under certain circumstances?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I think the term we use for that in the academy is critical thinking. So we say, we teach students how to apprehend the nature of the, you know, environment that they're going to enter, so that they're not fooled by it. They're not deluded by it. You know, they still have to make choices, and they still have some degree of, you know, freedom in making those choices, but they also need to understand, you know, exactly what the boundaries are, so that they can, you know, they can choose to change them if they want to. But they shouldn't be fooled. But I would say,
so we're kind of in back to Marx, right? That man makes his history, but not under a circumstance of his own choosing.
That part of Marx.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, speaking of kind of students today or younger people, you know, it's fascinating to think we're now in an age where the idea of individualism seems to be in abeyance, and you know, the idea of collective identities seem to be stronger and stronger in terms of, you know, we're talking about you know, race, racial groups, ethnic groups, gender or sexual orientation in kind of broad terms. What is, you know, how do you hope your book is read by, you know, say somebody who is, you know, a graduating senior from college now?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that I have a good answer for it. I don't know what, in, to what extent the book would constitute an intervention in the dynamic that you're describing, which is the tendency for people to identify with a collectivity of some kind. I mean, that's, that comes and goes in American political history. We're kind of in a deep state of it right now.
Yep.
People just identify with one group. That's white Americans as well as people of color. Mm-hmm. And obviously sexual differences and so forth. So that's a big issue. That's a big way people think about themselves right now. In the period I'm writing about, there is less of that. That is to say, the ideal, certainly this is true of existentialism. I think it's pretty true of the Martin Luther King led civil rights movement. It's true for Dan. The goal is integration and equality. The goal is erasing the kinds of arbitrary differences like skin color and gender that are preventing people from opportunity and so forth. That's not quite the same thing today. People don't want to give up their racial or gender identities. On the contrary, they want to be recognized for them and respected for them. They want equality of opportunity, for sure, but they don't want to give something up that's valuable to them in order to get that. You don't really see that before 1965, I think, to the same degree that you see it today.
Yeah, you know, at one point you write that existentialism was born in response to an experience of extremity, and you're talking specifically about France, but then you note that, you know, by the mid-60s, there was a general growth in affluence and robust economic growth. And then you say, in times of prosperity, concepts like freedom become increasingly abstract, and a philosophy of anxiety and risk no longer seem apropos, less a necessity than a style. Are we in that period of an almost post, you know, are we in a post-scarcity world where something like existentialism, as it appeared in the early post-war era, kind of makes less and less sense?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, Sartrean existentialism burst on the scene in 1945, so war's just ended. And you're looking at a landscape in Western Europe of complete material and moral devastation. So Sartrean existentialism offers kind of a way of thinking about that situation that many people found compelling. Late 1950s, early 1960s, the situation has completely changed because those economies, in addition to economies in the United States and around the world, have gone through this enormous period of growth. I mean, that's what's fantastic about this time is that the annual rate of growth between 50 and 73 is over 4% globally, not just in the Western Europe, the United States. In Japan, it's 11%. So, I mean, it's fantastic growth. That just changes the dynamics. You're no longer in a situation where you're confronted with dire choices, life or death choices, as you were during the resistance, let's say in Paris, in France. You're just confronted with all kinds of choices to make your life easier. Existentialism doesn't really seem necessary as a philosophy at that point. Are we in that situation now? I find the existentialist argument a little more compelling than I thought I would when I started writing the book, because I do think that you do want to be sure when you make decisions that you're making them not constrained by or determined by your personal circumstances. You're making a choice, a free choice, not a choice that's dictated by your race or by your gender or by your nationality or even by your philosophical commitments. You're making a choice freely. I sort of buy that. I mean, I'm not sure what freely exactly means there, but I sort of get that. That you want to feel you can be a person without being the person that you were born to be. In other words, that your Yeah, your existence precedes your essence, to use the Sartrean terminology, which he gets from Heidegger. I sort of get that, and I still think that's something that people should think about when they think about how they want to act in their lives.
That's a great note to end on. Thank you, Louis Menand, for talking to Reason about your new book, The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War.
Thank you, Nick. It's really been fun.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. I want to thank Inkl.com for advertising on today's show. Go to inkl.com/reason and get a great offer on an excellent best of news service. I also want to ask you to subscribe to this podcast so you never miss an episode. Go to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or make it easy on yourself and just go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.